Mitch Steele joins me this week to discuss seltzer and low-calorie beers. This is Beersmith Podcast number 225.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 225, and it's early November 2020. Mitch Steele joins me this week to discuss seltzer and low-calorie beers. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. If you've not downloaded the new Beersmith 3.1 update, grab it now as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, and add-ons and more. To download your free 21-day trial version, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, my guest is Mitch Steele. Mitch wrote the book on IPAs called IPAs, Brewing Techniques and the Evolution of India Pale Ale. Mitch is COO and brewmaster at New Realm Brewing Company in Atlanta, and formerly the brewmaster at Stone. Mitch holds a degree in fermentation science from the University of California at Davis. Mitch, it's a pleasure to have you back on. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Brad. How are you?
I am enjoying myself so far. You know, I've been working at home for 10 years, so not a big change for me. How about you? How's you guys?
Yeah, we're doing fine. We've struggled with this year, just like a lot of brewers, but we've been fortunate that a lot of our beer we were able to put into cans and get out into distribution. And as the draft business across the country dried up and across the Georgia and Virginia dried up, we were able to help ourselves a little bit by increasing our canned beer production.
Well, that's very fortunate you're able to do that, because a lot of companies obviously don't have that option. But how have you been dealing with the whole pandemic thing?
Well, we're sheltering in place. I've got 3 at-risk people in my house. So we've been taking it pretty seriously, and at New Realm, we're doing, some interesting things. I mean, we're doing separation, doing a lot of outdoor seating, and we have a lot of outdoor seating in both of our locations. So that's really helped and allowed us to create proper distancing. And, our staff all is required to, wear masks, wear gloves, use sanitizer between guest visits on the tables, and we've gone to the app-based menu option, so we don't have to have paper menus out in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And we shut down for a couple of months in both locations because during the early stages when everything was being shut down, and we've kind of gradually opened back up and are building back the business to what we thought it would be. We're still not quite there yet, but like I said, we're in a good position compared to a lot of breweries because we set ourselves up for distribution pretty strongly early on, and we had just opened up Northern Virginia when COVID hit, and so we were able to shift our focus to cans and make up some of the loss of draft.
And I think your main one is in Atlanta, right? And then you said you just opened a second brewery in Northern Virginia?
Yeah. So we, bid on the Green Flash brewing operation in Virginia Beach when it was repossessed by the bank and put up for auction. And this was in 2018. And we ended up getting it. And we've shifted a lot of our production up there. Not all of it, but they have a bigger system. They've got a 50-barrel brew house and 250-barrel fermenters. So it was, for me, it was like walking into Stone my first day in 2006. Just what I considered at the time to be a huge building with a lot of space. And, in my 10 years at Stone, we filled that up and had to build another building. I don't know if we're going to go that far here in Virginia Beach, but it's a really great brewery. And we were able to keep on three people that worked for the brewery when it was Green Flash. So they know the brewery backwards and forwards, which is great. And they're great brewers. So I love having them on the team.
That's outstanding. Well, today you actually wanted to talk about several topics, but one we haven't covered before on the podcast was seltzers. And you mentioned that you started making seltzers. Can you tell us a little bit about what seltzer is and maybe how it's made?
Sure. It's been an interesting process, to be certain. A seltzer is, there's a lot of different ways to make seltzer, hard seltzer, alcoholic seltzer, and we should clarify that this is hard seltzer that we're talking about. But the most common approach is to ferment a mix of sugar and water, and it can be either cane sugar or dextrose or something else that provides a high level of fermentability. And you mix the water and the sugar in your brew house and then ship it over to a fermenter and add the yeast, add some yeast nutrient, ferment it out. And then you're left with something that's got a little bit of yeast character and a little bit of color. And you need to get that out of there, because if you look at seltzers, they're very clear and they're very colorless. And then flavors are added to them. And so you get a drink that's very low calorie, low carbohydrate, 4-5% alcohol that has this pronounced flavor of whatever you're adding. And
I assume you're using artificial flavors or natural flavor. I don't know.
We're using natural flavors only and natural flavor extracts typically. So we found an extract company that we really like their products, and we've been using those in our seltzers, and it's worked out really well, and it's been easy to get those through the TTB for formula approvals. So that's been a bit of a good fortune there.
So, I mean, is this something somebody could do at home if they wanted to?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's quite simple, really. I mean, you put sugar in water and you heat it up to 185 degrees so that you sanitize the liquid. Mm-hmm. And then you chill it down and put it in a fermenter and add yeast and go. There are some tricks to it. There are some things that were, that make it sound pretty easy, but there are some tricky things that you got to figure out how to do. But
are you using brewer's yeast or some other kind of yeast? What ingredients do you use overall?
So that's a good question. For the sugar, we settled on dextrose just because it was readily available. According to TTB regulations, you can use any sugar, and they consider the whole thing a beer, which is really nice because then you're paying beer taxes on it. You're not paying it wine taxes or anything else. So we use dextrose in ours, and we've tried a couple of different sugars, but dextrose worked just fine. As far as the yeast goes, a lot of people are using champagne yeast, which I thought was interesting. And to be honest, we never tried that. We ended up going through Brewer Supply Group and finding a distiller's yeast and started off with that. Distiller's yeast is a very fast fermenter that can deal with pretty intensely stressful fermentations, which a seltzer, it turns out to be, is a pretty stressful fermentation because there are absolutely zero nutrients in a mixture of sugar and water.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, why do you need to use something like a champagne yeast or whatever, high gravity yeast, really? But I guess that's probably the answer. You don't have the nutrients that you normally would.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. And a lot of people that brew seltzers brew them to a fairly high gravity, like over 20 degrees Plato. and then they water them down. And you know, that's a trick that the large American brewers learned. You know, they're able to get a lot more capacity out of their fermenting cellars when they do that, because they're fermenting at higher gravity and then diluting it after it's finished. But you know, a lot of people do that with seltzers, apparently, and I think that's where the champagne yeast started being used. But we're using a yeast now called Pathfinder, and it comes with yeast nutrient. And I think that's the trick. One of the trickiest things about brewing seltzers is coming up with a nutrient combination that allows the yeast to really ferment out all that sugar in the absence of any other nutrients. And we've landed on this Pathfinder pure yeast culture that's got nutrients already added, and it's worked extremely well for us. So we're pretty happy with that process at this point.
And I mean, if you weren't going to use that, would you use some other combination of, you know, brewing nutrients that we might, you know, people might be able to get?
Yeah, there's a lot of practices out there. I know a lot of brewers are using diammonium phosphate or DAP. Brewers are just using regular off-the-shelf yeast nutrient, you know, like yeast X and things like that. And I honestly can't speak to how well those things work. You know, because we found this supply that has its own nutrient base in it, which is mostly DAP, diammonium phosphate, and probably has some zinc in there as well. I can't remember exactly what's in the nutrient pack.
Yeah, I mean, DAP is used a lot in mead making, at least, or was for a long time.
Yeah.
So what are some of the other challenges in making this seltzer?
Well, I think one of the main things is, you know, assuming you get a good fermentation and you're down and it's completely dry and everything is completed to your satisfaction, you end up with a liquid that's got a little bit of color, and it also has some haze to it, and it also has some pretty pronounced yeast character. And it's not intense, but it's kind of with our yeast, we get a what I would call a sourdough character to it. And with a seltzer, you want a very neutral base beer. I hesitate to call it beer, but I don't want to call it liquid because that's a sales term. You want to end up with something very neutral so that when you add flavor, there's no interference with the flavors that you're adding. And so I was talking with a guy who works for a supply company now for breweries, and he made seltzers for many, many years. And we sat on the phone for about 2 hours. And bottom line, you've got to get some carbon into the seltzer to strip all that stuff out before you add the flavors. A lot of brewers are using carbon impregnated filter sheets, but what we landed on in Atlanta anyway is a process where we just open up the top of the tank and we kind of cast out activated carbon over the top of the tank, and then it all settles out. And it was recommended to us to do a 24-hour contact with the carbon and then get it off the carbon. So we carbon fine the seltzer, and then we run the seltzer through a centrifuge, and that spits out all the carbon granules, and you end up with a very, very clear, very neutrally flavored liquid, which works great and it's pretty easy. But I think, you know, if we were going to do this really on a full scale production, you know, in an operating brewery, I might look at filter sheets or something. But the carbon fining piece and just adding some carbon over the top works really well.
And that the carbon, I guess, helps get the yeast to drop out, right? Is that part of the problem? And then does it help with the color as well?
Yeah, it definitely strips out color and flavor, and that's what you're looking for with the carbon. I forgot to mention that we actually do a biofine process to help get the yeast out before we add the carbon. So,
okay, so I'm just going to go down the list here. You mentioned color, haze, flavor, and yeast. So what are the steps you're using to eliminate all those?
So the yeast removal is with biofine or just, you know, any sort of silica-based agent. And then the color, the yeasty character, and the haze all tends to come out with the carbon and then the following centrifugation process. And the haze really, I think the haze really is pulled out by the centrifuge. But you know, we end up with a very clear seltzer base that is pretty neutral flavored. And, you know, it took us a lot of trials to kind of figure out the best process for us, but that's what's worked.
And how would you recommend doing this at home? Maybe use a carbon filter. I don't know, something like that. Obviously you can use finings.
Yeah. I think it depends on how technical you are as a home brewer. You know, certainly I know a number of home brewers that have filters and, you know, small plate and frame filters that they run their beer through. And I'm assuming that you can get carbon impregnated filter pads for a little plate and frame filter, but I don't know for sure.
Well, I know you can get carbon water filters, for example. Obviously, those are very common.
You know what? That's a good point, because we talked about doing that, and we talked about setting up a circulation loop on the fermenter and running it through an activated carbon filter housing. And in the end, we tried the fining process, and that worked and was easy. And so we ended up sticking with it. But that's certainly the person I was talking to about making seltzers, who had all the experience, recommended having a surge tank packed with activated carbon and then just circulating the seltzer base through that until it was clear. And that's more in line with using a small carbon filter in a housing, you know, and I think that would work very well.
And so after you get this liquid clarified or cleared out a little bit anyways, you're going to go and add flavor additions. And I know you've been working really hard on some flavor additions. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's critically important to find flavors that work really well. And that's one of the things that we found is we went through probably four or five different flavor suppliers and did a lot of benchtop testing where we'd have a measured amount of seltzer in a beaker or a graduated cylinder, and then we would add the recommended amount of flavor. And most of the flavorings come with a recommended addition amount. So we started off there, and then we adjusted it up or down depending on how we thought the flavor was coming through. But I think it's really a good practice to try a lot of different things, because you never really know what's going to work and what doesn't. And you know, we were surprised and disappointed by some of the trials that we did. We're like, wow, we thought this would be much better. And then there were other ones that we tried that we were amazed at how good it was. And I think it was kind of a fun process. But, you know, we tried, I don't know, probably 50 different flavors as we developed our seltzer line. And then we started making we make a 20 barrel batch of seltzer, and we make 4 or 5 barrel batches of flavors out of that. So, you know, we're lucky in Atlanta. We have a 20 barrel brewery, and then we also have a 5 barrel brewery. And so we just use those fermenters as mixing tanks on the pilot system for these small batches of seltzers. And that worked really well and allowed us to try a lot of different things. Cause when you sell, you know, 4 or 5 barrels of a seltzer to two restaurants, they go through it pretty quick, and we get some pretty good feedback from the people that are drinking them. And that helped us decide which 4 flavors we wanted to finalize and decide on.
So which flavors work best? I assume mostly you're working with fruit flavors probably, right?
Yeah, we haven't veered too far off the fruit flavor thing. We did a cherry cola seltzer that we all just loved. And it really had an authentic cola character to it. And then we used a blend of 2 different cherry flavors, and it was really popular with our team, but didn't do much in the restaurant. So that was one that we'd love to bring back at some time, but did not make the final cut. But we thought it was very good. We settled on, and I hate to use the word settled, because we decided, you know, we decided on black cherry, and the reason we did that was because it's a very popular flavor. It's probably the number one seltzer flavor out there, and we ended up using a blend of the same 2 cherry flavors that we used in the cherry cola, and it's very nice. We have a citrus seltzer that is a blend of 3 different citrus flavors. We have a blueberry acai I'm not sure I'm saying that correctly, but you know, that is a really nice, pretty pungent seltzer flavor. And then the fourth one we're doing is cucumber lime, which is one of those happy accidents. We didn't really expect it to be very popular. And in the summertime, it was our most popular seltzer by far. So that was really kind of cool. And it's a good one. You know, if I'm going to drink one, I'm probably going to drink that.
That's awesome. And then of course, you're going to finalize, this, and I mentioned you said the ABV is similar to a low alcohol beer or something like that, right?
It's a little bit higher because you've got less dextrinous material in it. So it's, you know, the ABV is 4.5, for ours ranges from 4.5 to 4.7% alcohol by volume. And that is designed to keep the calorie count on a 12-ounce serving under 100. So we're typically running 98 to 99 calories.
Wow. And then of course you're going to artificially carbonate it, right?
Correct. Yeah. We've got carb stones and just bubble CO2 through the tank, and that helps mix the flavor in as well.
And since it's fully fermented, you probably aren't worrying about filtering or package, you know, some of the packaging concerns you'd have to worry about perhaps with other beverages, right?
Yeah, it's really
pretty stable, right?
It's pretty stable. And from a shelf life standpoint, it's pretty amazing. We've got some seltzer that we did very early on that we put into crowlers, and we tasted them recently and they still taste just the same way they did when we first made them almost a year ago. So we're going to start putting our seltzers in cans next year, and we're going to give them a 1-year code date, which was a nice surprise. I didn't expect that.
That's nice. Yeah. So, I mean, you don't have to worry about a lot of the issues you have to worry about with cider and other things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people are making sweet seltzers and I imagine that they're adding some sort of preservative or they're pasteurizing. I'm not sure exactly what they're doing, but we just went with dry seltzer. That's all end fermented out. Doesn't really pose any sort of risk.
Well, I know some beer drinkers look down on the whole seltzer thing, but what are some of the business and practical reasons you're making seltzer now?
Yeah, that's something we wrestled with philosophically quite a bit before we actually pulled the trigger and started making some. Here's kind of what swung it for us. Number one, it is the fastest growing category in this mid-level, mid-strength alcoholic beverage, and you can make it with a brewery license. You know, you don't need a special TTB license to make it. So it's pretty easy to slide into your portfolio, and it doesn't cost anything to start doing it. For us, what we found in our restaurants, our two restaurants are pretty good sized restaurants, and we get a lot of young people there. Mm-hmm. And we get a lot of people in our restaurants that don't drink beer. They just don't prefer beer. And because of Georgia alcohol laws, we can't bring in wine or guest beers or spirits unless you're licensed to do so. And so we had a lot of people coming in wanting cocktails and wanting wine, and we couldn't give it to them. Legally, we just couldn't serve it. And so seltzers provide us with a reasonable alternative to beer for those people that come in that don't like beer, which is a pretty good amount, especially on the weekends. I mean, we get some hardcore real beer fans in here a lot, but you know, on the weekends we get people. We're located on the Beltline in Atlanta, which is a walking path that is probably we're on the busiest stretch of it. And on weekends when the weather is nice, there are thousands and thousands of people that walk past our restaurant, and a lot of them just pop in to get a drink. And you know, they don't know craft beer or anything. They just see a place that looks cool and they come on in. And having seltzers in the lineup for them has been a huge bonus for us.
Yeah, I mean, how does that compare with some of the other popular alternatives that brewers are making, like cider, for example?
Yeah, with cider, you need to have a winery license, and that's why we haven't done cider. And we have made a beer a couple of times for Virginia Beach, because ciders apparently are very popular in Virginia Beach. And we've made a beer that's the 49% of the fermentables come from apple juice. Mm-hmm. So it's technically still a beer, but it's got a lot of cider characteristics to it. And that's been kind of fun. And typically we add you know, very low hopping, and we'll add another fruit. So you get like a raspberry cider or a cherry cider or something like that. And it's quite drinkable and quite good. But, you know, it's not gluten free. And that's the big draw of seltzers and ciders.
One of the big draws. Well, yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah, a lot of people are gluten, have gluten sensitivity issues. So,
yeah.
Any closing thoughts on the seltzer before we jump to topic number two, I guess, how somebody might do this at home?
Yeah, I think the couple of the key points, if I was going to brew one at home, I'd want to make sure I had very, very neutral water, no chlorine in the water. So, distilled water with a little bit of mineral additions, because the calcium is going to help your yeast. Is probably the best way to go. Get a yeast that can handle, a high gravity fermentation or a fermentation mm-hmm. without a lot of nutrients. Try to find nutrients. You know, I don't know what kind of nutrients are available to home brewers, but, I believe that the yeast that we are using with the nutrient packet with it is available to homebrewers, but I'm not positive. But your yeast choice is going to be critically important. You can't just use a regular beer yeast and expect it to ferment out. You got to use something that's a little bit more high octane on the fermenting side. Make sure it's end fermented, that it ferments out. So you got to watch your aeration. Make sure you aerate it properly. You don't have to aerate it any more than beer, or wort. But just make sure that you've got good aeration in your fermenter. And then I think just sprinkling carbon over the top. If you're fermenting in a carboy or a small fermenter, homebrew size fermenter, just sprinkling carbon over the top. And there's an addition rate that's out there, and I don't remember how much we're using. I wish I could share that. I just don't remember. It works pretty well. Leave the carbon on for a day and no longer than a day, because otherwise, it starts releasing flavors. Apparently that's what we were told.
Interesting.
At that point I'd probably just, rack the seltzer off the carbon. The carbon should settle out at the bottom. And you can rack it off or go through a filter, like we talked about, a small filter.
Yeah, a carbon filter is possibly an alternative. I just had a quick question popped into my head. How low is the gravity that you're working with at finishing gravity? I assume it's below one, right?
Yeah, it's usually in between -1 and -2, usually right in the middle, right around
-2 Plato, then it would be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, the second topic you wanted to actually cover was low-cal and low-carb beers. And I get this question all the time. How can you make a low-cal beer or a low-carb beer for people that are on low-carb diets, for example? So I throw it over to you. How do you do it?
Well, there's really no way to get the calorie content in a regular strength beer below 100 unless you're using an enzyme. And what I'm talking about is amyloglucosidase enzyme, or an enzyme that's going to break down all the dextrins in your mash or your wort into fermentable sugars. So that's what we're doing. We are adding an enzyme in the mash. We're holding the mash for a long period of time, and then we're mashing off at a low temperature. We have a separate louder tun, so we do a mash off process, but when we were doing these on our pilot system, we just held it from avoided sparging for a long time to keep that enzyme active in the mash and really break down the residual dextrins. And that's kind of the key to brewing these beers. You know, start off with a low gravity beer, add the enzyme. So you want your gravity to be somewhere.
You're talking about planning for like a 5% beer or something, 4% beer?
Yeah, 4% alcohol. So if you get the enzyme activity, your original gravity only needs to be, 7 to 8 degrees Plato.
Right.
And that gets you a beer that's you know, right around 4, maybe just over 4% alcohol. The enzyme also means that you don't have any residual dextrins in the beer, and so you've got a low carb product just by the nature of what you're brewing. And you know, this whole thing for us, and I know other people have been doing low carb beers for a long time. You know, Michelob Ultra has been out there for close to 20 years now. when we were doing Brut IPAs back, you know, a couple of years ago when those things first hit, and we were using the enzyme and we were brewing beers that were 6 to 7% alcohol, and I was looking at the calorie contents on those beers, and it just was like a light bulb going off. I'm like, shoot, if we hit a 4% alcohol beer, we'd be under 100 calories, and we'd probably be under 5 grams of carbohydrates. And so we started brewing low alcohol versions, because Brut, you know, as you know, kind of came and went. Brut IPA came and went.
Yeah, I think we talked about it in a previous episode that you were on. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it promptly died as a style.
Like Zima, right?
Right. But anyway, we just kind of transitioned into doing low alcohol beers, and trying to get low calorie and low carbohydrate beers. And you know, our internal name for this beer is Better For You IPA, but that's not what we're going to call it. That's just kind of a category descriptor that we use internally. But we did several versions of it. And, you know, people that are watching their carbs, that are on keto diets and that kind of thing, really seem to appreciate it. So that's been good. And we're going to start putting this in cans next year as well.
Nice. I wanted to ask you about the enzymes that you're using, and also what are some of the brewing challenges when you add these enzymes to the beer?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, when I first was learning about Brut IPAs, there were brewers that were adding this amylase enzyme in the fermenter, and that really gets you dry. I mean, that gets you bone dry, because that enzyme just acts and acts and acts and acts throughout the fermentation. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit uncontrollable. And the problem that we ran into, which I probably talked about when we talked about Brut IPAs back in the day, but the problem that we ran into with that process was that the residual effect of the enzyme impacted the next beer that went through that fermenter.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it got into the gasket material or something. And even though we CIP'd the fermenter, we did not strip clean it. And so the next beer we brewed into it, which was an IPA, just a regular IPA, I think it finished around 1 degree Plato. And we're like, okay, something's wrong here.
It's not good.
Yeah. And so, you know, our big concern when we started thinking about doing this on a production level was, we can't have active enzyme in this beer and run it through a can line with a lot of soft parts. Otherwise, we're going to have enzymatic activity in our other beers as they get canned. And so we started researching how to do it in the mash. And when I was with Anheuser-Busch...
That's interesting. I didn't know you were doing it in the mash, actually.
Yeah, and so we use a low mash temperature, you know, 147. Or so, mm-hmm. And we add the enzyme and we hold it for about 3 hours. And the enzyme does its thing. And then, like I said, when we transfer to the louder tun, we don't do a normal heating up process. You know, normally brewers will heat their mash up to maybe 165 to stop the enzymatic activity.
Call the mash out, right?
Yeah, right. You know, control your fermentability. And so we don't do that. We allow that enzyme to continue working as long as possible. And so we don't do a mash out temperature. We just send it over at 147 into the louder tun and let it rest through Vorloffing. The foundation water that we use in the louder tun is also low temperature. We don't normally, it's 165 or 170 degrees Fahrenheit, and we don't heat it that high for this beer. We actually go with a lower temperature, and I think that helps keep the enzyme activity running until we start sparging.
Interesting. So, I mean, are you killing it off in the sparge, or are you killing it off actually when it gets to the boiler and starts hitting boiler temperatures?
I think it's mostly killed off by sparge, but because these are so low gravity beers, we tend not to have to sparge a lot. So I suspect that we're getting the real enzymatic kill in the boil.
Hmm. And then I assume the boiling temperature kills it off. And then the other question I want to ask is, do you end up with contamination issues in the mash tun now?
Not that we've seen.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, because when we follow it with a regular beer, we're raising to mash off temperature and killing the enzyme and, you know, and then running it through the louder tun and sparging with 170 degree water. So we have not seen any residual impact in the mash tun from using the enzyme in it. That's a good question though.
Yeah. I just wondered because obviously, you know, you run that risk, I guess, but it depends on what the range of temperature is for that enzyme. I have no idea when it actually cuts off, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's around 160. I'm not positive. You know, we looked at that number when we figured out how we were going to do this. And I think it was right around 160, maybe 165 degrees Fahrenheit.
So, I mean, that's pretty cool. So you basically just run this enzyme through, it breaks down the dextrins while you're in the mash. And then I assume you go with a regular boil and a regular process from then on, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's everything after that is the same as making a session IPA.
Hmm. And then, of course, the other challenge I wanted to ask you about is how do you get the right balance now in the beer? Because you've taken away all these dextrins, which normally provide body and flavor to your beer. And especially, I think you said you're making IPAs. How do you get the balance, the malt hop balance, I guess?
Yeah, that's a real challenge. Anytime you're doing a session IPA, I think there are a couple of things that work. Number one, you get a much different hop character at a lower alcohol level than you would at 5, 6, 7%, especially with a dry hop. And so that can mess up the balance of the beer. And then the other thing is that without those dextrins in the beer that give it body, those dextrins also counteract and balance out the bitterness from the hops. So with a beer like this, with a low alcohol, low carb IPA, we found that about 20 to 25 IBUs is the most you want to have in it. Otherwise, it just is overwhelmingly bitter.
So you're basically killing the, you know, or significantly reducing the hop inputs, right? I assume probably throughout the process, no? Because you're also doing dry hop and whirlpool too, right?
Yeah, and most of our beers, we dry hop at about 1.5 to 2 pounds per barrel total. And with this beer that we're making now, we're sticking right at about 1 pound per barrel. Because otherwise, at that low alcohol, that hop character tends to get somewhat vegetal and plant-like and not floral or fruity, you know, that we're looking for. And if you go too heavy on the hops in a low-carb beer, you tend to start pulling character out of the hops that you don't want. Hmm.
So you're cutting hops across the board then, right?
Yeah.
So definitely. Another question, can you make a more malty or dark style as a low carb beer, or is that not possible?
No, I think it is. You know, we started off doing a pretty traditional IPA, you know, just using a base malt and no colored malts. And then we ended up deciding to make ours a hazy IPA. And so we're adding about 30% wheat. And we do see some differences in the enzyme activity when we made that change. We weren't getting quite as effective enzyme activity, but we were getting a little bit more dextrin in the beer and a little bit more body. So, you know, as long as we were able to maintain the calorie count that we were looking for, we thought that would be okay. But I would imagine that, you know, using a dark malt would not seriously impact the ability of the enzyme to break down the dextrins. And, you know, most of those dextrins in dark malt, I don't know for sure. I think, you know, I think that's something worth looking at. But certainly, you know, when you look at a beer like Guinness Stout that's 4% alcohol and is very light in character, you got to think that it's possible if you want to take it a step further and make it a low-cal, low-carb kind of beer.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that beer still has a lot of body to it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's but from a calorie standpoint, it's less than a Budweiser, which always surprised me, you know. So, Guinness, I love Guinness. I think it's a wonderful beer, but I think its appearance is deceiving in some ways, you know.
So, I mean, is this something that, for locale brewing? Is this something you think some folks can do at home? I believe you can get a hold of the enzyme, although I haven't tried myself.
Yeah, I believe you can too. And I think, apart from that, it'd be pretty simple. And certainly, if you have experience brewing a session IPA, you can make a low-cal IPA. The only additional step is the enzyme addition.
And everything else you're doing basically the same, right?
Yeah. With the reductions in hops, when I did a session IPA at Stone, I actually hopped it very heavily, and it was a hop tonic. I think some of the negative feedback we got on that beer was that it was just overwhelmingly hoppy and not balanced, which, I took that and tried to learn from it. So I think, as long as you dial back on your hopping and dial back on the bitterness to account for the fact that you've got nothing to balance those things out, you're going to be okay.
Interesting. And then I think the last thing you want to talk about was the popularity of non-alcoholic beers, which of course is sort of taking the locale to the extreme, right?
It is. I don't know where this is going to go. It's something we've been keeping our eyes on for a while. And what I'm hearing is that in Europe, it is becoming very popular. And in fact, I've reached out to some of my friends in Europe, and they confirm that. They tell me that people are, they'll drink non-alcoholic beer all day long, instead of drinking water or drinking soda or tea or whatever. And I've seen that in action on some of the Zoom calls I've been on. People are just drinking non-alcoholic beer, and it seems to be a much bigger thing in Europe than it is in the United States, and probably bigger than it ever will be in the United States. But just the same, it's a trend that I think bears watching, because a lot of people are looking at, as they get older, cutting back on their alcohol intake and cutting back on their calorie intake. And so we've been researching NA beers, I knew a fair amount about brewing NA beers back when I was at AB. We made O'Doul's, and then I was involved in the formulation of O'Doul's Amber. And through that process, we tried a lot of different beer styles and stripping the alcohol from them. And it was really apparent to me that a craft beer with all that flavor would survive that process better than what we ended up putting in the O'Doul's bottles. But, it just wasn't the right time for something like that. But now there are craft breweries that are 100% focused on NAs, like Athletic Brewing, and they're having great success with it. So I think it's a category that has a home in America, but just how big it could potentially become, I don't know.
So are you, you have some top secret pilot projects going on to develop an NA beer, or?
Not really yet. So we have done some, and I was talking with a supplier of a reverse osmosis alcohol stripper. I think they're based in Minnesota, and they offered to run some beer through their system for us so we could check it out. Mm-hmm. And we took our Munich Dunkel and our German Hefeweizen and ran them through this process, and then they sent the kegs back to us. And it tasted great. I mean, it's very thin. It doesn't taste like beer, but it had a lot of beer characteristics to it. And I was pretty impressed with it. And so, I shared that with our team. And I think everybody was like, okay, if we want to do this, we know we can make something that's pretty good.
Well, that was one of the questions. I did an episode with a person that runs a non-alcoholic brewery several months back. And they talked about, there's a whole variety of methods you can use. You can boil off the alcohol, you can freeze it, you can, there's a whole bunch of different things. You can filter it like you're doing. What are your thoughts on those? Because it sounds like you've had some experience with it.
Yeah, there are a lot of different ways to do it. I think one of the more popular ways and the easiest ways is to use a yeast that does not produce alcohol when it ferments. And I know I've heard that the Heineken NA product is made that way. They have a yeast that does not ferment maltose, apparently. And I know that in the past, even, you know, back when it was just the big three American brewers that were making non-alcoholic beers, I think Coors was also using what was called an arrested fermentation method, which is where you brew something that's got a very low gravity and you throw yeast in there and you allow the yeast to start, but then you stop everything, you pull the yeast off, you chill the tank down, and you, that way you get some fermentation esters in the product, but you don't get the alcohol. And, you know, in my mind, those were always very, very sweet and very hard to manage. But I was talking with my friend, Ollie Vesalo, who brews in Hamburg, and he's brewing two of these beers now. And he uses a newer strain of yeast that doesn't ferment maltose. And he's, you know, he's adjusted his gravities properly. And, you know, so that he gets the right balance of flavors and not too much sweetness. And then he dry hops it and makes it an IPA. And he says it's become his most popular beer.
Wow, that's crazy.
And I'm like, oh boy, okay. I think the most common method, at least what I see out there, is a vacuum distillation process where you're under a vacuum, you're heating the beer up and evaporating the alcohol off of the beer. And you can do that when you have a vacuum, the boiling point of alcohol is reduced significantly. So you can heat the beer up, and I don't want to misspeak, but the temperature is, I don't know, 120, 130 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, normally alcohol burns off maybe like 170 something, I think, but
yeah,
and of course, so Fahrenheit.
And so the vacuum process, putting the beer under a vacuum, reduces that boiling point of alcohol. So you don't necessarily heat treat the beer. It's not just boiled and the alcohol's boiled off. It's It's a process where you're separating out the alcohol and leaving everything else behind at a temperature that doesn't do a lot of damage to the beer flavor, which is really important.
And you mentioned doing an osmosis filter. That's a method I hadn't heard about. They have some kind of a filter that can just remove the alcohol, I guess.
Yeah, it's a typical reverse osmosis process where you have you run the process at the start to create a liquid that has everything in the beer. You know, pulls everything out of the beer, and then you I believe what you do is you heat that product up and remove the alcohol from it. So you've got no alcohol on one side of the membrane. And then as you're passing your beer on the other side of the membrane, the alcohol then goes through via osmosis into that other solution. And you end up, but none of the beer flavor is stripped out because that solution already has
all. Well, and it sounds like you're avoiding heating a lot of the beer flavor, which is where some of the off flavors come off from a traditional distillation, I think. Yeah,
exactly. And I, you know, when I was at Anheuser-Busch, we did in Fort Collins, they had a modified dialysis system, you know, and dialysis is used to treat kidney disease.
No kidding.
And it was a dialysis machine that had been modified by the engineers at AB to run beer through. And it worked. And in the other breweries, they had the vacuum distillation systems. And there was a bit of a difference in flavor there, you know, that you could tell. And I think the systems, you know, in the past 20 years have only gotten better, you know, at alcohol removal. But yeah, reverse osmosis seems to be the thing with a lot of the smaller systems that are out there that are more affordable for craft brewers.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. We talked about seltzers, a little bit about cider, non-alcoholic beers. I want to get your closing thoughts. Where are we going next, maybe with craft beer?
I wish I had a crystal ball. This is something we talk about all the time. You know, the seltzers aren't going to go away. They're going to continue to remain very popular. The problem or the challenge with seltzers and, you know, the popularity of seltzers is that is not a beverage that's going to lead people to beer. And that's what scares us a little bit. It's a beverage that is probably most likely going to lead people to cocktails. And for that reason, we're paying very close attention to what's going on with ready-to-drink cocktails that are in cans. I don't know if we're going to get into that, but we certainly are talking about it. You know, at this point, I think if you're a brewery and you're counting on growing your business with just beer, you're going to have a rough road. And it doesn't mean you won't be successful. And certainly the more established breweries are going to have a better go of it than breweries that are trying to enter the market and enter into increasingly tough distribution channels. You know, but I think, you know, to survive as a business, I think, you know, we've made the decision to branch out a little bit, and a lot of people have. And, you know, the one thing that I've learned over the years is with craft beer is that it's always changing. And the people that don't pay attention to what's going on and where the trends are going are the ones that tend to get left behind and, you know, and sometimes don't survive. And, you know, I remember, you know, when hazy IPAs came out, and I was skeptical of them, to put it mildly, you know, about whether they had staying power or whether it was going to be anything more than a fad. And of course, I was proven wrong with that. But, and our number one beer right now is a hazy IPA, but I still know brewers that absolutely refuse to brew them. They just don't think they are a legitimate beer style, which I 100% disagree with. But, you know, it's nice to have principles, but you're running a business and you need to feed your family too.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Mitch, appreciate you coming on the show today and taking the time out of your very busy schedule to talk with us.
Yeah, absolutely, Brad. It's always good to talk to you.
Again, my guest today was Mitch Steele. He's COO and brewmaster at New Realm Brewing Company in Atlanta, and also formerly the brewmaster at Stone. Mitch, thank you again for coming on. Really appreciate it.
You bet, Brad. We'll talk to you next time.
Well, a big thank you to Mitch Steele for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 Brewing Software a try. If you not download the new Beersmith 3.1 update for both desktop and mobile, grab it now, as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. I'd like to thank you for listening, and I hope you have a great brewing week.